and reform in the Middle East. We are pleased to have with us Isabel Coleman, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. This event is sponsored by the World Affairs Council and co-sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations, the International Museum of Women, the Global Fund for Women, and Books, Inc. I'm Sara Abbasi, a trustee of the World Affairs Council, and I'm honored to be your moderator this evening. The World Affairs Council of Northern California invites you to join us in seeking knowledge, expanding your networks, and discovering innovative solutions to global problems. More information about the organization can be found on our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you're unable to attend a program, we offer two excellent ways to stay connected. You may listen to our weekly radio broadcast, It's Your World, on Monday evenings on KQED. And on our website, you can find an audio and video recording of all our past programs. Today's program is being recorded for radio, and we thank our audio engineer, David Ogilvie. Before we begin, it would be greatly appreciated if you could silence all cell phones and anything else that might disturb the program. Please also take note of the blue question cards on your seats. I would encourage you to write your questions, and council staff will come by to collect them. Finally, I would like to announce two programs that might be of interest to you. Next week, on Wednesday, May 26th, the council welcomes Ayan Hirsi Ali, an outspoken defender of women's rights in Islamic societies. Ali will discuss her life since leaving the Netherlands, as well as attempts to reconcile her Islamic past with her passionate adherence to democracy and Western values. This event will be held at the Herbst Theater at 6:30 p.m. Then the next day, on Thursday, May 27th, join us in welcoming Ron Hasner, Professor of Political Science at UC Berkeley. Professor Hasner will offer insight into the often violent dynamics that come into play at sacred sites where religion and politics collide. This event will take place in the Coliseum in the Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. Isabel Coleman is Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations and Director of CFR's Women and Foreign Policy Program. Her area of expertise include economic and political development in the Middle East, regional gender issues, educational reform, and microfinance. Prior to joining the Council on Foreign Relations, Dr. Coleman was CEO of a healthcare services company and a partner at McKinsey & Company in New York. She was formerly a research fellow at the Brookings Institution and an adjunct professor at American University, where she taught political economy. In her new book, Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East, Dr. Coleman examines how women are bringing about reform in the Middle East within an Islamic framework. She joins us tonight to highlight a new generation of women leaders as they struggle to transform their societies. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Isabel Coleman.
Thank you, Sara. Is that on? Yeah. Thank you, Sara, so much for that nice introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. I was arrived early this morning, and I have sort of done back-to-back events here in San Francisco, and I was walking to one of the events this afternoon thinking, sadly, how little time I have spent in this beautiful city. I think I've spent more time in Islamabad than I have in San Francisco, and shame on me, because it's, well, nothing against Islamabad, but San Francisco is a whole lot nicer. Anyway. You know, let me start out by saying a little bit about how I came to write this book. My background is really in economics and economic development, and my focus for a decade has been on the Middle East. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look around the Middle East and see that, from an economic perspective, that the underinvestment in women has been a problem for that part of the world. And my Middle East is not just the Arab world, which I think people generally think of as the Middle East, but I write about a broader Middle East, which also includes Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. So there's a pretty broad cross-section of countries there. But although these countries are very, very different, some are wealthy Gulf oil states, others are very, very poor, underdeveloped countries like Afghanistan. One thing that is consistent across all of them is that women have greatly struggled for rights, and that struggle has been against very deep-seated culture, patriarchy, tradition, and religion. There is a religious overlay to many of the constraints facing women, a religious justification used to keep women's rights from progressing, to roll back women's rights in some countries. And there have been many, many very brave and passionate and ardent secular feminists over the years who've pushed a women's rights agenda, but their reach has been limited. Their dialogue has been mostly among urban elites, and they have struggled to create a grassroots-based women's movement in much of that part of the world. So the question then becomes, given the imperative, the economic imperative, the social imperative, the political imperative to improve women's rights in the Middle East, how is that going to happen in a part of the world where the very notion of women's rights and feminism has been labeled as a negative ism? A Westernism, colonialism, secularism, communism, these are all negative isms that have been associated with feminism. So as I travel around the Middle East and I spend time talking with people in government, people in the private sector, people in the civil society, the NGO community, people at the grassroots level, one thing that becomes clear is that it's very difficult to fight against religion. So this religious justification that is used is very strong. You've had the rise of a political Islam in that part of the world. And women today, and men are very much a part of this, men and women are searching for different strategies and different approaches and different methods. And one thing that they're doing is looking increasingly within religion as a way of pushing back on conservative religious interpretation with progressive religious interpretation. You can think of it as fighting theology with theology. Let me talk about four different women that I write about in my book, just to give you a sense of the types of people who are engaged in this, and they're very, very different and approach it from different perspectives. And some of the women who are engaged in this, what I refer to as Islamic feminism, and by that I describe in the book, Islamic feminism is simply using Islam and Islamic justification to promote women's rights. Let me just start with that term. It's a loaded term. Most of the people in the book wouldn't like that term. They don't agree with the term, either because they don't like the Islam part of it. Yes, they are using Islamic discourse, but they don't want to be identified as Islamist or Islamic, even though they are people of faith and Muslims for the most part. And others don't like it. They don't like the feminism part. That comes with all sorts of baggage that they'd rather do without. So they don't like it for a variety of reasons, but from my perspective, what they're doing is promoting women's rights using Islamic justification, and I call it Islamic feminism. Four of the women that I write about in the book, let me just tell you how I chose the women to write about in the book. There were hundreds and hundreds of women I could have chosen that I've come across during the years. I didn't choose famous people to focus on because I didn't want readers to think that it's only a few select famous people who are exceptions. There are indeed literally hundreds and thousands, and probably tens and thousands, if not millions of people engaged in this process. Some at a local level, some at a national level, some at an international level. But I chose just ordinary people who I came across who had interesting and compelling stories to tell. One of them is a woman named Muzda Mulia, who grew up in a very conservative family in Indonesia. In fact, her grandfather told her that if she came into contact and touched the hand of a Westerner, that she must immediately go home and shower because that was contact with an infidel. And it was only when she got older and she grew up and she continued in her education that she came to understand, well, that's actually not the way of the world. And that's not sort of mainstream Muslim thinking, that there's a different approach out there. And she began to question a lot of what she had learned as a young woman. And she went on and pursued her Islamic studies and became a noted Islamic scholar herself. She even studied at Al-Azhar in Cairo. She learned Arabic. She came back to Indonesia and is a very well-known Islamic scholar within her own society. And she has been a real bastion of reason in Indonesia among all of these conservative scholars who have been promoting Sharia in her country. And one of the things that she likes to say is, you know, it's not a fax from God, Sharia. It's man-made law. It's open to interpretation, and therefore we should interpret it. It makes drives the Indonesian clerics crazy, but she's got a lot of academic credentials and learning behind her, and she really holds her own with these people. And she's become an inspiration to millions. And Indonesia, by the way, is the largest Muslim country in the world. And she's become an inspiration to millions of moderate Indonesians and to millions of Indonesian women. She's very well known in her country. Another woman that I write about in the book is a very courageous woman named Sakina Yacoubi, who some of you might have run across. She has been here in San Francisco in years past and is on the board of an organization just down the street, the Global Fund for Women. So I know she comes through San Francisco from time to time. Sakina runs a series of schools and clinics for women. She grew up in Herat in western Afghanistan. Her father sent her to the local mosque for education, an unusual thing to do as a child growing up in the 1960s in Afghanistan. But he was very determined that his daughter learn to read and write and be educated. Until one day the local mullah came to him and said, you know what? I've taught her everything I can possibly teach her. She's now really gone beyond me. You're on your own. I don't know what to do with her anymore. And through a series of serendipitous factors, which included a local American Peace Corps volunteer living nearby who convinced her father to allow her to go to the United States to continue her education. She came to the U.S. She worked multiple jobs, put herself through school, even as her country disintegrated around her. And she managed through sheer hard work and pluck to bring her family to the United States after the communist invasion, after the Soviet invasion of her country. And once they were all sort of safely settled in the Detroit area, she then packed up and left and went back to Peshawar, where she said she was desperately needed to help her countrywomen. And this was now during the years of civil war. She worked in camps in Peshawar, opening up schools for Afghan girls, refugees. And people said, you're crazy. How are you going to get these Afghan girls in school? And she said, I'm going to convince the mullahs that this is a priority. And so she did. And not only did she get the mullahs on board, but this took off like wildfire. And before you knew it, she had hundreds of thousands of young girls in camps across Peshawar. Then came the Taliban. She then opened up secret schools in Afghanistan, continued her schools in Pakistan. And after the fall of the Taliban, she has now opened up schools all across Afghanistan. And she understands the cultural, social, and religious constraints she's up against. She treads very carefully. She is very careful to wear the headscarf, the hijab. And she makes all of her female employees do the same. And when they push back, she says to them, what's more important to you, this piece of cloth on your head or being able to do the work that we so desperately need to do in our society? Now, some of you may disagree with that, but the fact is that in very conservative parts of Afghanistan where she's working, which is very, very dangerous for her, you know, she's trying to take every precaution possible so that she can keep her schools open. She is working then carefully and closely with local leaders and local mullahs to make sure that her schools are safe, that her girls are safe. And she teaches, once they're inside, she teaches them. I've sat in on some of her classes. She teaches them everything from their rights within Islam to democracy and human rights and reproductive health. Actually, it's quite remarkable to see the very graphic posters up in her clinics in some of these rural clinics across Afghanistan, teaching women about birth control and condoms and all sorts of things. And I say to her, you know, how do the men play into this? And she says, well, I bring them here if any of them have questions, and we even go through passages of the Quran together, and we all get comfortable, and people seem to go along with it. Another of the women that I write about in the book is a woman named Dr. Haifa Jalal Alel, who is running a very innovative women's college in Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia, as you all know, is ground zero of extremist thinking in many respects. But here's a woman who has opened an innovative women's college. I mean, she didn't open it herself. She was hired to run it. And she's teaching there very interesting pedagogy, critical thinking skills, questioning, reasoning, analytics. She's introduced computer science, engineering, all sorts of technical degrees to prepare her female students for the global economy. Now, again, she has to tread quite carefully. And she manages to work within the traditional confines of her society, but she's pushing on these boundaries all the time. And the first time I went to visit the school, it was a college, not a university then. The male teacher was in one classroom, and all the female students were in another. And he taught via video conference because they were not allowed to be in the same room together. I went back a few years later, and some of the girls had said, you know, this is ridiculous. We should just be in the classroom with the male teacher. And they had said, well, if you can get permission from your parents, we'll allow that. Half the students did. Now, half the students were in the classroom with the male teacher. The other half of the girls were still in a separate room. So I go back a few years later. They're all in the same classroom with the male teacher. And I say to them, you know, when I first came here, the man was in a separate room. And they looked at me amazed. Really? How long ago was that? And I said, well, just 5 years ago, you know. So there is change happening. I don't mean to sound as if this is some revolutionary change that women are now in the same classroom as a male teacher in Saudi Arabia. But today, there's a very profound dialogue going on within that country over what does Islam say about mixing, about the ability of men and women to be in the same place together at the same time who are unrelated. And these were, this is a dialogue that I wouldn't have predicted just a few years ago that's taking place very publicly with senior members of the ulama coming out and saying that it's un-Islamic, and in fact, people promoting it should be killed. This is the definition of extremism. And others coming out and saying, absolutely not. There's nothing un-Islamic about it. And the king, in fact, fired one of these clerics who was making these statements. So you see that there's this tension within society that's going on and a debate over what does Islam actually say about women's rights. And that's one of the things that I reflect in this book, that this struggle is not really over what the West wants women to do, or the West versus the Islamic world. It's within the Islamic world. You know, it's between extremists and more moderates within these countries who are really struggling and debating some of these issues. The last woman that I'll talk about briefly is a woman named Sundus Abbas Hassan, who is a secular woman, grew up in a very secular environment under Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and finds herself living now in a very religiously charged country with a elected Shia majority, and has found her world closing dramatically around her and her secular constitution has now been replaced with a constitution that has all sorts of nice language in it about equality and freedom of religion and freedom of speech and equality, gender equality, and it also elevates Sharia to the very highest levels. So in the Iraqi constitution, it says no law can contradict the tenets of Sharia. So she's living in an environment where she's very unsure of what that means and how that will be interpreted for her rights. And she was very, very disappointed when, after the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the creation of a new government, that there were so few women who were involved in it. And one of the senior Iraqi government officials at the time said to her, well, there aren't any women. You know, there are no women that we can put in government. We'd like to, but there just aren't any. So what did she do? She started something called the Women's Leadership Institute that promotes women as leaders. And she works, even though she herself is a very secular woman, she understands that a big part of the future of her country will be determined by these Shia religious parties. And so she specifically works with some of these Shia women. And she describes the process of transformation that occurs. They come to her fully covered in the abaya. They are reluctant to speak. They're very shy. They're very diffident. And she coaxes them. Well, just try a minute on camera. No, 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 no. And suddenly she's got them a minute on camera. Then she's got them 3 minutes. Then she's got them 5 minutes. And then in last year's election, several of her trainees ran for parliament. Were doing bang-up campaign videos on television, and several of them were elected. And so she is part of a process of leadership training, of change, that includes women from all different walks of life within Iraq today. So my point is not that secular approaches are somehow not good. I'm a secularist myself. I'm happy to live in a secular country. But that these are societies which are not secular. And frankly, I'm not sure that they're trending towards secularism. And that is the reality. And here I would like to quote Shirin Ebadi, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in Iran. And she says that she wishes that the fight for women's rights did not involve interpreting religious texts. And then she says, but is there an alternative battlefield? Desperate wishing aside, I cannot see one. And so this is, to me, a reality, perhaps an unfortunate reality in many respects, but it is a reality. And women are finding ways to deal with that reality. And again, some are secular women who are using Islamic discourse as a tactic. Others are approaching it from positions of great faith and trying to reconcile faith and their rights and human rights and democracy in general. The process is certainly more advanced in some countries than in others. I started out talking about Musta Mulia in Indonesia, one of the more moderate Muslim countries in the world, with a very, very well-grooved women's movement that is very active at the most local levels, very involved in family planning, women's reproductive rights, very involved in education and curriculum and what is taught to boys and girls about the role of women in society, and has really been the women's movement in Indonesia, I think, a bulwark against rising conservatism and extremism that we've seen in Indonesia. But they've really held the line in many efforts to change laws in that country. And of course, it's less advanced in other places. You see stirrings of this in Saudi Arabia, but not a well-developed women's movement there by any means. So what are some of the key drivers of change? I talked about education. The women that I profile in the book, for the most part, are well-educated women. And despite the fact that in the Middle East, many countries, and in Southeast Asia in particular, have underinvested in female education compared to other parts of the world, they're beginning to catch up. So today you have rising levels of female literacy and female education. In Iran, 70% of college graduates today are women. It's not just a simple majority, that's a supermajority. In Jordan, girls outnumber boys at the secondary school level. In Saudi, as I said, 63% of college graduates are women. So you have rising levels of female education, and with rising levels of education comes rising levels of awareness, of activity, and engagement. Engagement in society, but also engagement in religious discourse. Questioning, what does the religion really say? Another driver is the media. You've seen an explosion in the last decade of new media in the Middle East. You've seen new formats. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the show The View here in the United States. What you might not know is that there is a version of The View in Arabic called Sweet Talk. It has four women sitting around in a very similar format to Barbara Walters and her coterie of women here. From different countries. One is Egyptian, one is Palestinian, one is Saudi, one wears the headscarf, the others don't, and they talk about very personal, sensitive issues. Polygamy, incest, divorce, custody, domestic abuse. 42% of viewers are men. They're intrigued by this. You know, they don't get a lot of this female discussion going on. But what shows like Sweet Talk have done is bring these conversations of very sensitive issues into people's living rooms and opened up space for debate, dialogue, discussion. Another driver is the economy. You have a growing awareness on the part of people in the business community, certainly, among some government leaders, among people in civil society, that the restrictions on women are simply bad from an economic perspective. I'm sure you're all familiar with the long and fruitless quest for women in Saudi Arabia to get the right to drive. You know, in recent years, you've had members of the Shura Council, which is sort of an advisory group to the king, standing up and saying things like, "What is the point of importing Pakistani labor to drive our women about, and now we're spending $4 billion a year to pay for that labor, and it's all going back to South Asia in remittances?" And, you know, it's a different level of conversation. It's not, you know, they're trying to move it away from simply, you know, the culture and the tradition and put it in economic terms. So you definitely see some economic arguments entering into this. And women are very savvy about latching onto those economic arguments and pushing for it. My Saudi chapter is entitled Channeling Khadija. Khadija was Muhammad's first wife. She was a very successful businesswoman who she hired to drive her caravans. And he did a great job, and she proposed marriage to him. He married his boss. It's one smart thing he did. He married his boss. And the women in Saudi, they say, "We just want to be like Khadija. We want to own our own business. We want to be successful businesswomen. We want our rights to engage in economic activity." And, you know, very much putting it in economic terms, which seems to be less threatening and more promising than some other approaches. And lastly, I would say another driver of some of these changes is extremism. Extremism within these societies. And people understand intuitively a linkage between extremist views on women and extremism in general. Now, Morocco, for example, experienced a wave of terrorism that was very devastating to Casablanca and some other cities in Morocco. And after that, the government started making changes that had been percolating already for some years, ideas. But one program that they put in place was to train women as religious leaders. They call them morshidat. They can do everything that the men can do except lead the Friday prayer. And the idea behind this, well, you know, it's good because women can relate to men and women on social issues and this and that. But if you read through what some of the government ministers said about this, they also said, "We hope this will be a way of mitigating extremism in our own society. That by having women out there in some of the the slum areas of Casablanca and Rabat and other places, talking to men and to women and discussing religion with them, that it will be a way of tempering some of the more extremist ideas. So I'm going to wrap up, but let me just close by saying that, you know, I'm often asked, is this a movement, or is this just sort of isolated women in various countries? Is it a movement? Is it coming together? You know, how do we read this? And, you know, my answer today is different from when I started writing the book. You know, I started writing the book, it was sort of interesting, and there were these groups of people, and, you know, I thought it was a little bit more marginal and isolated than I do today. Today I see the makings of a movement. The women are sharing best practices across borders, across countries. They're meeting in global meetings. They're setting up global organizations. You know, the women in Morocco used religious justifications to change their family law, very sensitive family law that deals with marriage, divorce, custody, all of these things. And they succeeded in reforming their Mudawana, the family law, in 2004. And this became an inspiration to women across the region. And there were similar efforts initiated from Jordan to Egypt and to Iran. Iran has a whole campaign called the Million Signature Campaign, modeled very explicitly after what the women in Morocco did to reform their own repressive legal code there, dealing with family law issues. There was a global movement that was launched called Musawa, which means equality, that brought together women from around the world who are really trying to drive change in their own societies. From the United States, some of these participants, to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, to Indonesia, to Malaysia. So many of the women I wrote about in my book were at this conference, you know, coming together, sharing ideas, sharing tactics, strategies. So I am beginning to see the makings of a global movement. Will this be a straight line to change and progress? No. Has it anywhere been a straight line? No. I think that there'll be forwards and backwards. There'll be progress in some countries more quickly than in others. You know, the women in Kuwait, their suffrage movement was a full-on 10 years. Ours in this country was more than 70 years. And today, there were four women who were, not today, but last year, there were four women elected to the Kuwaiti parliament who are now very well regarded in their political system. And when I started writing my book, women didn't even have the right to vote. Or when I started thinking about my book, not actually writing it, but doing research on it. So change is happening. It'll be slower in some places, faster in others. And I encourage all of you to get on the right side of history and support and encourage the change that is happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. It's now time for us to take questions from the audience, and I will read them out. The first question is, on what theological grounds do the extremists prevent the advancement of women? After all, the Prophet Muhammad, as you said, worked for his wife, and she was a successful businesswoman at an era when women did not have such a role in the West. Can you speak to that?
Well, let me start out by saying I don't pretend to be an Islamic scholar. But there are centuries of Islamic scholars that have debated these issues. And some of them have come up with very narrow and extremist interpretations. What I should say is very narrow interpretations. And today there are extremists who are using violence to enforce those narrow interpretations. And over the centuries, there have been progressive interpretations. Many religious texts, there are contradictory things in the Quran about women. Some are very progressive, and some are not so progressive. Some are actually quite repressive towards women. And what you see are the conservatives focusing on certain elements, and you see moderates trying to focus on other parts and also trying to contextualize those elements that are problematic. And it's a process that has been going on for a long time. I think it's getting some renewed energy today, but there also, not only in the Quran, but there are the sayings of the of Muhammad, the sayings and doings of Muhammad, which make up the hadiths. And in there are some very problematic things for women. And there are a number of efforts to say, well, what are these hadiths and where did they come from? Some of them were not, you know, discovered for centuries after Muhammad lived. And, you know, there's efforts to say, well, what role should the hadiths play in our interpretation? And efforts to give them a lesser role than they've had. So I think it's a process that's going on. I'd like to see it sped up. I think that when you look at religions around the world, it's not dissimilar from a process that has gone on in other religions.
Thank you. Similar sort of vein, how can women ever achieve equality in Islamic countries when conservative Islam and the Quran considers them inferior to men? So address that. But there was also, there's a wonderful example in the book where you meet with someone in Saudi Arabia, and they're talking about paradise beneath the feet of women and how the women turned that around. If you could just somehow perhaps tie that in, how they're changing it.
Well, it's where the title of the book comes from. And again, it's one of these hadiths, a saying of the of Muhammad, where he's asked by someone, he wants to go off and wage jihad. And Muhammad says, do you have a mother? He says, yes. And he says, well, stay with her because paradise lies beneath her feet. That's where the title comes from. And when I was in Saudi Arabia some years ago, a well-intentioned Saudi man says to me, well, you know, the reason we don't allow women to vote, we don't allow them to drive, we don't allow them to leave their home without permission, we don't allow them to own their own business and blah, 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 is because, you see, we in Islam, we revere our women. Unlike you in the West, we really revere our women, and we have a saying that paradise lies beneath the feet of mothers. I thought, okay. So later, a group of Saudi women say to me, well, you know, the reason we should be allowed to drive and the reason we should be allowed to vote and to own our own business and to drive and to do all these things is, you see, in Islam, there's a saying that paradise lies beneath the feet of mothers. And I thought, okay, well, that sums it up for me. So
that was wonderful. You mentioned this a little bit earlier in your talk in terms of extremism, but this question is, you mentioned the very rigid religious framework in Islam that serves to keep women behind. Do you see a parallel with the Islamic within the Islamic framework and how it relates and sees the West?
I'm not sure I totally understand that question.
I think it was more sort of in terms of the extremism and the extremist view, or more of the conservative view of women, and as a, you know, sort of that tying into then having a more conservative, rigid view of the West as well within that.
Well, I do think that. You know, I said this earlier, I think extremist views on women go along with extremist views in general. The example I gave of Musda Mulia, one of the women I write about in my book, whose grandfather told her she cannot touch the hand of a Westerner, that she would be, that's an infidel and unclean. You know, that that interpretation, I don't think leads to a lot of cross-cultural understanding, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. And that interpretation goes hand in hand with very narrow views on women, for the most part. You don't find people talking about needing to wash hands after touching a Westerner and yet having progressive views on women. They typically, you know, don't go together. So I would say that what we're talking about is a more moderate interpretation that leads to more moderate views on issues like understanding the other, be it other non-Muslims or other Muslims. You know, we have terrible sectarian issues within the Islamic faith today, on questions of jihad and questions about women. You know, and I talk about this in the introduction of my book, is these are three huge and profound issues within Islam today. And the book deals with one of them, which is questions about women, but they are somewhat interrelated.
This question is about sort of more the youth becoming more conservative, that the Middle East is experiencing a demographic boom of youth. And why is the youth becoming more conservative, let's say, than their sort of parents were in countries like Egypt, rather than a force for progressive change?
Well, and it's absolutely true that you see among young people a rising level of conservatism. And I quote in the book some world value surveys that show that among young populations in the West, there is now take-it-for-granted attitude of gender equality. And that is not true among young populations in Muslim-majority countries, which are growing up in a more conservative environment than that of their parents, and more outwardly pious and religious environment. What is the cause of that? I think that there are multiple causes of that. One is frustration on the part of the youth with authoritarian government. It's frustration with the failure of their governments to deliver to them, and the belief that, to quote the Muslim Brotherhood, that Islam is the solution. This is the motto of the Muslim Brotherhood, that somehow Islam is going to deliver the social justice that they desire. And the most secular country that I have visited in the Middle East, population today, is Iran, ironically, which has lived under theocracy for 30 years and is disillusioned with that as a solution. And I think that there's a hunger in Iran for more democracy and less theocracy.
This question is in terms of what parallels with the women's movement in the U.S. What parallels do you see when comparing the women's movement in the U.S. to that in the Middle East?
Well, one parallel is that, you know, these changes take a long time. You know, it was the struggle for, if you just look at the women's suffrage movement in this country, was launched in 1848 in Seneca Falls, and it wasn't until 1920 that women got the right to vote. And during that time, women who were suffragettes, who were leading that movement, were labeled as being communist, as being atheists, as being anti-Christian, as undermining the family. Many of the same types of slurs which are labeled against women in the Middle East who were pushing for women's rights. So I think you can see some parallels. You know, again, I would reiterate that it takes we're talking about long-term cultural change, and it does take a long, long time and requires a lot of effort, and it also requires men to be very much involved. I mean, ultimately, women's rights have been really have progressed in the United States not only because of the energy of women, but also because of the involvement of men.
And there are several questions relating to the examples that you've given in terms of the change coming about are women working very much within their local context. One of the questions is there a need for women in the Middle East or in the Muslim world to connect and learn from each other? Or is each local commitment too specific to work across borders?
No, I do. I think that they desire to learn from each other and are learning from each other. They're sharing strategies. They're sharing best practices. Manuals that are developed in one country, I see being translated into different languages and used in another country. And it's not just from other Muslim women. I mean, there's a lot of interaction with women in the West, Muslim women in the West, Muslim men in the West. I mean, a lot of the religious interpretation and the justification of these Islamic feminists come from scholars who may have been born in Pakistan or in Egypt, but have done their intellectual exploration in the more open societies of the West, where they've had the intellectual and academic freedom to pursue their lines of scholarship and inquiry. And, you know, some of them reside here in California. One of them is Khalid Abu al-Fadl at UCLA, who has been a very inspirational Islamic scholar to many of the women's movements, and his arguments are used by women's movements across the region. So I think there's an intra Middle East sharing, but also involving women's groups from the United States. I mentioned the Global Fund for Women. They're an important funder of many of these movements and women's movements. So I see a lot of connection between not only within the Middle East, but outside of it, too.
This next question has to do with your travels as you went around the Muslim world sort of researching. You must have come across Muslim women who were suspicious of a Western woman looking into and promoting women's issues within Islam. What are their arguments, and how would you respond to them?
Well, one of the suspicions I always got was the first question. The first thing out of people's mouths would be, "Why are you so obsessed with what we wear?" And I say, I haven't asked you about what you wear. I haven't said anything about what you're wearing. But I would explain that I'm here to listen, and I'm here to tell their story. I'm a writer. I'm here to simply listen and understand. And, you know, then we'd strike up a conversation, and most of them eventually would become comfortable with me. I must say that when I was in Iran, the women were particularly uncomfortable and told me, I mean, I was there as a guest of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I could not, I'm a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. I could not go to Iran as a tourist. So I somehow, and that's another whole long story, got myself a visa to go as a guest of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But I had minders the whole time I was there. They were young women who followed me around to every meeting and were there, I guess, to keep an eye on me. And they told me that they begged their supervisor not to have to take this job. You know, they don't want to get involved. They don't want to, you know, have any trouble. But over the course of my time there, I spent a lot of time with some of these women, and they actually opened up completely, told me all about their love lives and told me all about their everything and took me to their, their fun, you know, after-work activities, which included going to a firing range to fire guns and taekwondo. I mean, it actually, they became the most interesting part of my trip to Iran.
Yeah, fascinating.
Can I tell my story, which you liked? So was
yes,
it you would like to?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, at the end of my visit in Iran, I was asked to go to the bursar's office. I thought, what's this about? And so I get hauled in front of the bursar, who presents me with a bill for the minders. And I didn't know what to do. I don't want to run into trouble with the authorities in Iran, but I'll be darned if I'm going to pay for my minders. And I was, for one of the first times in my life, speechless. I just sort of sat there frozen. I really didn't know what to do. And before I could do anything, the woman who was one of my minders at that time, she just lights into the guy. She starts screaming at him in a Farsi tirade, like this. And other men walk in, and there's now five men, and she's screaming at all of them. And they all sat there like this. And then she finishes. And she turns to me, and she takes it, and she goes, whoosh, 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 like this with the bill. And she says, "I'm sorry, there was a mistake." I'm telling you, that's the future of that country.
That's wonderful. There are several students in the audience, and they've written down some wonderful questions. The first one is, how can students in their own ways support this discourse for women's reform in the Middle East?
Well, one of the students we met earlier with told me that they had started an initiative I think it was a Facebook page, to connect with students in the Middle East. And I think that's terrific. I think that there's a lot of misconception in our country about what life is like for people in the Middle East, and there's a lot of misconception in the Middle East about what life is like here. I mean, I was telling the students that, you know, people in the Middle East are avid watchers of television. The most popular show is Baywatch, and they all are convinced that American women are all Pamela Anderson. And, you know, I think to be able to use things like social networking sites like Facebook to have interaction and connection and talk about what your life is like in the United States, and maybe the fact that you have Muslim friends and what their life is like, and actually to engage. You know, there's so many different organizations that support different initiatives to help empower women, both economically, politically, educationally. There's so many great organizations that are based here in San Francisco. Get involved.
Great. Thank you. This question is, how far do you see the local cultures impacting the interpretation of Islam as far as women are concerned? And this particular questionnaire wants to know, it appears to me that what you have talked about this evening does not apply to women in northern Cyprus, Turkey, Bosnia, Albania, maybe some of the Central Asian countries.
Well, I'm not, you know, I'm not sure that it doesn't. There are conservative interpretations of Islam in all of these countries. Even in a secular country like Turkey, you know, you've seen the rise of a more conservative, Islam. But you also see within Turkey, you know, signs of outward piety and conservatism. Of course, the wearing of the headscarf in Turkey, but nevertheless, you know, the it's a mixed picture there. You've got the AKP, the ruling party there, has gone to great lengths to promote women politically. You know, promote women as mayors, to promote women in parliament. So, you know, there it's a difficult sort of nuanced picture. But I would say that the tensions that I'm describing are there in all Muslim countries. They're here in the United States. You know, we have many moderate Muslims, but we also have conservative mosques here teaching and promoting a very conservative view here in the United States.
Thank you. Next week, as I mentioned earlier, the World Affairs Council will be hosting Ayan Hirsi Ali, whose contention is that Islam is incompatible with women's rights and other progressive Western thought. How would you respond?
You know, my response to that is, whether or not it is incompatible is almost beside the point, because these countries are Muslim countries. They're not secular countries. They're not democracies. They're not even trending in that direction. And there are many men and women who are determined to find an accommodation and a compatibility. And I write, the book is writing about their efforts and their quest to do that. And, you know, in her reading, she may, you know, very firmly believe that. I know she does. But I think that there are millions of people who don't believe it, who think that it can be, that there can be an accommodation. And the book is, you know, writing about their attempts to do that at a very grassroots level. And I wish them luck.
Turning towards sort of more of the government role, do you think if U.S. NATO pulls out of Afghanistan, would you see, what type of effect would you see that on women's rights?
I think eventually the U.S. and NATO forces will pull out of Afghanistan. It's not a question of if, but when. And I think that you'll find Afghanistan becoming very regionally different in this respect of women's rights. It will look, in fact, somewhat like Pakistan, which is which is your home country, where you know that there are areas of Pakistan that are really quite progressive and urban and more liberal, and they're very conservative areas within Pakistan. And Afghanistan, I think, will end up looking somewhat like that. You'll have in the south and east of the country, where you have very strong Pashtun culture, you will have a restriction of women's rights. I don't know that it's much of a restriction than exists already today. I mean, you have a very still a very restricted environment in the south and east of the country. There are whole areas where there are no girls' schools still because it's too dangerous to open girls' schools today. Whereas in the west and in the north, you have a much more open environment. You know, around Mazar-e-Sharif, it actually looks today like Pakistan, you know, and in the West, you know, there's a very heavy Iranian influence, and you see more economic activity. It's a more secure environment. I think you'll see different evolution for women in different parts of the country, and you know, sadly, it will be a very long slog in the south and east of the country for women.
And in terms of the sort of more progressive, more cosmopolitan areas, it seems that it's easier for women working on this to share information. Are you seeing any kind of connection and exchange of ideas with women in some of the more the rural, remote areas? And if so, in what way? And do they have access to information? Is it through radio?
In Afghanistan?
Pakistan, Afghanistan,
all over, yeah.
Throughout.
Yeah, I mean, certainly through radio, through television, and through the efforts of NGO groups. I mean, I write about in the book. I write about how Sakina Yaqubi, who I mentioned, uses a manual that really takes women through their rights within Islam. And she tells me, you know, that manual was developed by a small NGO in Washington, D.C., called the Women's Learning Partnership, which has looked through the Quran and pulled out all of these passages that refer to various women's rights and translated it into, you know, 20 different languages, one of them being Dari. And there it is being used in rural Afghanistan. So, you know, you see how this information is beginning to flow from, you know, the halls of academia to the NGO community down to the activist and grassroots level, even in a place like rural Afghanistan.
This particular question is specific to Saudi Arabia. If a high percentage of Saudi university graduates are women, are they taking jobs away from men, and is this creating any type of resentment?
So, as I said, 63% of Saudi college graduates are women, but only 5% of the workforce is female. So I would say those men's jobs are pretty safe right now. But let me tell you something interesting, because I talk with labor ministers across the Middle East, and they say to me, we can't even begin to think about jobs for women. We have to create jobs for men, because if men are not employed, you know, they're the ones who really cause trouble. You know, we have to make sure that there are jobs for men. And I share with them the very interesting research that's been done by a whole range of different organizations, including the World Bank, that countries that in the Middle East that have a higher percentage of female labor force participation have lower levels of unemployment. And what the research says very clearly is that women are not taking jobs from men. It's not a zero-sum game. In fact, women are engines of economic activity and are creating jobs for other women and creating jobs for men. And so when you have women involved in your economy, it's a more robust and dynamic economy, and that really catches their attention, I must say. And I do hope you'll read the book, because I describe in there the very energetic entrepreneurial spirit of these Saudi women who really are hungry to be Khadijas, to be business women and entrepreneurs. And, you know, in that part of the world, entrepreneurship is so important. There's such high levels of unemployment. Governments cannot absorb all these workers as they have in the past. And yet, you know, in the rich Gulf countries, frankly, the men are not particularly hungry, and the women are. And, you know, I see that across the region.
Another question from a student, and it's similar. It's Two questions from students, and they're both very similar. They're wanting to know, in terms of more progressive and more conservative countries, in your travels, which Muslim nation have you found to be sort of the most conservative, and which one the most progressive?
Again, within countries, you know, you find very conservative and very progressive. I mean, Pakistan is a country with, it had a, you know, a woman president, you know. It has some very progressive elements, but it's also got deeply conservative elements. Indonesia, I described earlier, as, you know, relatively quite a moderate Muslim country. Turkey has a long tradition of secularism, and women's rights are protected in that secular system. Tunisia, again, a secular system. Women's rights are protected in that secular system. You know, Tunisia is a country that legalized abortion in 1956, long before countries in the West. Turkey had, in 1930, under Ataturk, had the first women Supreme Court justice. You know, I mean, very advanced for women's rights in some of these countries. You know, I would say Saudi Arabia stands out as the most conservative country. You know, it's never had secularism, and, you know, it's led by a conservative, theocratic monarchy.
This question is, how do you see this reform movement in the Muslim world affecting women's rights issues in non-Islamic Christian societies in Africa and other adjacent countries to some of the Muslim countries you've mentioned?
Well, I do think that there is a, you know, Islam is an expansionist religion, and you've seen a rise and a growth of Islam in Africa, and it has been a particular brand of Islam. It has been a conservative brand of Islam for the most part in recent decades, and that has been driven by wealthy conservative Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia in particular. And so to the extent that you see that, you know, conservative brand of Islam being pushed into Africa and Southeast Asia and here in the United States, you know, I think it does have an impact. And to the extent that women are able to push back on some of that conservative interpretation at the root of it, over time, I think you will see it having an impact in other places in the world.
And now for the final question, and this is from a student. Being both a foreigner and an advocate of women's rights, have you felt unsafe and or threatened in Islamic nations?
You know, I really don't travel around as an advocate for women's rights, I must say. You know, I'm a researcher, I'm a writer. You know, I don't know that's my calling card. You know, I'm a writer about the Middle East. Have I felt unsafe? Certainly I felt unsafe, not because of the research I'm doing, but because I'm in Afghanistan, and it's an unsafe country, and I'm afraid that a roadside bomb is going to blow me up. I am a foreigner, not that anybody knows what I'm working on, but clearly I'm a Westerner, and the most insecure thing today is to be pulled over on the side of the road and grabbed out and kidnapped for ransom. So, you know, recently when I've been there, I've traveled with security, not to protect me against the roadside bomb, but to protect me against possible kidnapping. In a country like Saudi, no, I've never felt unsafe. In Iran, you know, I certainly never felt unsafe from bombings, but did I feel unsafe that maybe I'd get arrested? Well, yeah. Okay, yes, I did. But you know, generally, traveling around, you know, you realize that there are, you know, the random violence that can occur. But I live in New York. Random violence occurs there, too. Anyway.
That concludes our program for the evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council.
Thank you.
On behalf of the World Affairs Council, the Council on Foreign Relations, the International Museum of Women, and the Global Fund for Women, I would like to ask the audience, which you've already done, to join me in thanking Isabel
Thank
Coleman
you.
For the wonderful presentation.
Thank you.